for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. And we'll begin today with The Machines Finding Life That Humans Can't See, written by Marion Renault. Across a Swiss meadow and into its forested edges, the drone dragged a jumbo-sized cotton swab from a 13-foot tether. Along its path, a moistened swab collected scraps of life, some combination of sloth skin and hair, mucus, saliva, and blood splatters, pollen flecks, and fungal spores. Later, biologists used a sequencer about the size of a phone to stream the landscape's DNA into code, revealing dozens upon dozens of species, some endangered, some invasive. The researchers never saw the wasps, stink bugs, or hawk moths whose genetic signatures they collected. But all of those and many more were out there. The researchers from the Swiss Federal Institute for Forest, Snow, and Landscape Research were field testing a new approach to biodiversity monitoring, in this case to map insect life across different kinds of vegetation. They make up one of many teams now deploying a suite of technologies to track nature at a resolution and pace once unimaginable for taxonomists. We know a lot more about what's happening, Camille Alboy, an environmental scientist at ETH Zurich, and a member of the team, told me, even if a lot still escapes us. Today, autonomous robots collect DNA while state-of-the-art sequencers process genetic samples quickly and cheaply, and machine learning algorithms detect life by sound or shape. These technologies are revolutionizing humanity's ability to catalog Earth's species, which are estimated to number 8 million. Though perhaps far, far more. By illuminating the teeming life that so often eludes human observation, only about 2.3 million species have been formally described. The rest are nameless and unstudied, part of what biologists call dark taxa. Insects, for example, likely compose more than half of all animal species. Yet most, an estimated 4 out of 5, have never been recorded by science. From the tropics to the poles, on land and in water, they pollinate, prey, scavenge, burrow, and parasitize an unobserved majority of life on Earth. It is difficult to relate to non-specialists how vast our ignorance truly is, an international consortium of insect scientists lamented in 2018. Valero Caruso, an entomologist at the University of Padua in Italy, studies scuttle flies, a skittering family containing an estimated 30,000 to 50,000 species. Only about 4,000 have been described, Caruso told me. One lifetime is not enough to understand them all. The minute distinctions within even one family of flies matter more than they might seem to. Species that look identical can occupy entirely different ecological niches, evading different predators and hunting different prey, parasitizing different hosts, pollinating different plants, decomposing different materials, or carrying different diseases. Each is a unique evolutionary experiment that might give rise to compounds that unlock new medicines, behaviors that offer agricultural solutions, and other adaptations that could further our understanding of how life persists. Only with today's machines and technology do scientists stand a chance of keeping up with life's abundance. For most of history, humans have relied primarily on their eyes to classify the natural world. Observations of shape, size, and color helped Carl Linnaeus catalog about 12,000 species in the 18th century. a monumental undertaking, but a laughable fraction of reality. Accounting for each creature demanded the meticulous labor of dehydrating, dissecting, mounting, pinning, labeling, essentially the main techniques available until the turn of the 21st century, when genetic sequencing allowed taxonomists to zoom in on DNA barcodes. Even then, those might not have identified specimens beyond genus or family. Now technologies such as eDNA, high-throughput sequencing, autonomous robotics, and AI have broadened our vision of the natural world. They decode the genomes of fungi, bacteria, and yeast that are different or impossible to culture in a lab. Specialized AI isolates species calls from noisy recordings, translating air vibrations into an acoustic field guide. Others parse photo pixels to tease out variations in wing veins or bristles, as fine as a dust mote, to identify and classify closely related species. High-resolution 3D scans allow researchers to visualize minuscule anatomies without lifting a scalpel. Other tools to map dynamic ecosystems as they transform in real time, tracking how wetlands contract and expand season by season, or harnessing hundreds of millions of observations from citizen science databases to identify species and map their shifting ranges. One unassuming setup in a lush Panamanian rainforest involved UV light luring moths to a white panel and a solar-powered camera that snapped a photo every 10 seconds from dusk until dawn. In a single week, AI processed many thousands of images each night, in which experts detected 2,000 moth species, half of them unknown to science. It breaks my heart to see people think science is about wrapping up the last details of understanding and that all the big discoveries are done. David Rolnick, a computer scientist at McGill University and MILA, Quebec AI Institute, who was part of the expedition, told me, in Colombia, one of the world's most biodiverse countries, the combination of drone-collected data and machine learning has helped describe tens of thousands of species, 200 of which are new to science. These tools' field of view is still finite. AI algorithms see only as far as their training data and taxonomical data overrepresent the global north and charismatic organisms. In a major open access biodiversity database, for example, less than 5% of the entries in recent years pertain to insects, while more than 80% related to birds, which account for less than 1% of named species. Because many dark taxa are absent from training data sets, even the most advanced image recognition models work best as triage, rapidly sorting through familiar taxa and flagging likely new discoveries for human taxonomists to investigate. AI systems don't have intuition. They don't have creativity, said Rolnick, whose team co-created Antenna, a ready-to-use AI platform for ecologists. Human taxonomists are still better at imagining how a rare feature arose evolutionarily, or exploring the slight differences that can mark an entirely new species, and ultimately even identification, whether by algorithm or DNA or human expert, still depends on people. That human labor is also a dwindling resource, especially in entomology. The number of people who are paid to be taxonomists in the world is practically nil, Rolnick said, and time is against them. The world's largest natural history museums hold a wealth of specimens and objects, more than 1 billion according to one study, yet only a fraction of those have digitally accessible records, and genomic records are accessible for just 0.2% of biological specimens. many historical collections, all those drawers packed with pinned, flattened, and stuffed specimens, all those jars of floating beings, are chronically underfunded, and their contents are vulnerable to the physical consequences of neglect. Preservation fluids evaporate, poor storage conditions invite pests and mold, and DNA degrades until it is unsequenceable. Today's tools are still far from fully capturing the extent and complexity of Earth's biodiversity, and much of that could vanish before anyone catalogs it. We are too few, studying too many things, Caruso, the Padua entomologist, said. Many liken taxonomy to cataloging an already burning library. As Mehrdad Haji Babai, chief scientific officer for the Center of Biodiversity Genomics at the University of Guelph in Canada, told me, "We're not stamp collecting here. Taxonomists are instead working to preserve a planetary memory, an archive of life, and decode which traits help creatures adapt, migrate, and otherwise survive in a rapidly changing climate." The climate crisis is unraveling the life cycles of wildlife around the world, by one estimate, for about half of all species. Flowers now bloom weeks before pollinators stir. Fruit withers before migrating birds can reach it. Butterflies attuned to rainfall falter in drought. Tropical birds and alpine plants climb toward cooler, though finite, mountaintops. Fish slip further out to sea. Disease-carrying mosquitoes ride the heat into new territories. Extreme weather at the poles stresses crucial moss and lichen and shreds entire habitats in hours. Mass die-offs are now routine. "Once you lose one species, you'll probably lose more species," Caruso said. "Over time, everything is going to collapse. One in eight could vanish by century's end, many of them dark taxa, lost before we ever meet them. Most countries and global bodies, such as the International Union for Conservation of Nature, cannot assess and therefore cannot protect unnamed organisms. As Edward O. Wilson told Time in 1986, it's like having astronomy without knowing where the stars are." Today's machine-assisted taxonomy faces the same problem Linnaeus did. Nature's complexity is still far outstrips human insight, even with machine's assistance. "We don't perceive the world as it is in all its chaotic glory," the biologist Carol Kasuk Jung wrote in her 2010 book, Naming Nature. "We sense a very particular subset of what surrounds us, and we see it in a particularly human way. On the flip side, every new data point sharpens the predictive models guiding conservation," says Evgeny Zakharov, a genomics director for the Center of Biodiversity Genomics. "The more we know about the world, the more power we have to properly manage and protect it," he told me. "With tools, the speed of taxonomists' work is accelerating, but so is the countdown. They will take all the help they can get." Today's second story, Inside Russia's Musical Underground. This is written by Anna Nemtsova. On a recent summer night, hundreds of young Russians assembled on St. Petersburg's main street to hear songs that the government had banned. It was the latest gathering of the country's musical underground, and anger at the Kremlin was on full and loud display. A rock group named Stop Time played recent anti-war songs as well as an old anthem, originally by the Soviet-era band Kino, that has become a symbol of political resistance. "Changes, our hearts demand changes," the vocalist sang. "Changes, our eyes demand changes." A few bikers paused their deliveries to join the chorus. Stop Time and many of its underground peers perform out in the open despite the threat of prison. Last month, the group played a song by the rapper Noize MC that imagines Russia's future after President Vladimir Putin. Somebody good will come to power. He will fix everything unexpectedly. He will punish those bastards. Nobody will get away. A few days later, police detained members of the group. They were released and back performing again soon after. Street concerts and underground gatherings offer a rare hint of hope for the many young Russians who have grown disheartened by Moscow's prolonged war and deepening repression. Musicians have become influential activists and symbols of political resistance, just as they were in the final years of the Soviet Union. The Kremlin has repeatedly tried to suppress the music scene and punish its leaders, a sign that Putin seems to understand the danger they pose. But despite the persecutions, the underground is showing no sign of being silenced. In fact, it's growing. In addition to arresting musicians, Russian authorities have designated many of them as foreign agents, including Noize MC, who left Russia soon after the war broke out. People don't want to hear, think, or talk about the war. They push it out of their conscience, the rapper, whose real name is Ivan Alexeyev, told me. The tragedy, he said, is the indifference and apathy that many Russians feel. To call attention to the war and raise funds for their Ukrainian victims, Alexeyev performed a series of international concerts with a fellow Russian superstar, Monichachka. Although some of Alexeyev's music has been banned, millions of Russians still listen one way or another, singing it in the streets and in karaoke bars, or streaming cover versions online. In May, a St. Petersburg court outlawed a song that Alexeyev described to me as his most extremist hit so far. Its name, Cooperative Swan Lake, plays off the Soviet Union's decision to air the eponymous ballad on state TV whenever a state leader died. Today, Russians still know Swan Lake as a signal that a new chief is coming. I want to watch the ballet, he raps, Let the Swans Dance. Also encoded in the title is a reference to Lake Cooperative, a plot of land in northwest Russia where Putin's inner circle gathered for vacations. In one line, Alexeyev referred directly to Putin. Let the old man shake in fear for his lake. Banning the song turned out to be useless. Millions of people simply listened to it on YouTube. Indeed, many bands like these have backfired on the Kremlin. In the mid-1980s, when I was growing up in Russia, Moscow outlawed groups such as Pink Floyd, Black Sabbath, Kiss, the Sex Pistols, and Iron Maiden, along with dozens of underground bands. But that only made them more popular. All the young people I knew made a point of listening to band music. Homegrown rock bands were especially beloved. In 1972, Boris Grebenshchikov founded Aquarium, which would become one of Russia's most popular groups. In 1984, the government banned Aquarium, but Grebenshchikov and his band continued to perform in the city center. By the final years of the Soviet Union, Grebenshchikov was the biggest star of the underground in St. Petersburg, then Leningrad. During Soviet rule, the KGB routinely spied on young artists, including those in the emerging rock scene. The Federal Security Service, the KGB successor, is taking up a censorship campaign very much like the one that Moscow waged. Putin's regime is more aggressive. In August, FSB officers arrested the 37-year-old punk musician Vladimir Bolobolov, who has said that he was beaten and tortured. Authorities have accused him of storing explosives, but he insists that he was framed. Several weeks ago, law enforcement accused Agalia Tarasova, a 31-year-old television and film star who has spoken out against the war, of smuggling 0.4 grams of hashish into Russia. Because of the Kremlin's escalating repression, some musicians who still live in Russia keep a low profile. I recently heard a song written by an artist whose fans don't publicize his music out of fear that the regime will imprison him. Someone had sent it to me on Telegram because it wasn't available on YouTube. Russia's war, he sings, has left Russians as black as coal. Earlier this month, Alia Pugacheva, Russia's most famous pop star, condemned the regime in a nearly four-hour interview with a popular Russian journalist. Pugacheva, who left the country in 2022, used the occasion to address Putin about the war. Just end it. Yuri Shevchuk, the now 68-year-old frontman for the rock group the KGB banned in 1980, has been similarly outspoken. In the years after of the war, he told the stadium full of fans, "Motherland, my friends, is not the president's ass that someone has to constantly lick and kiss. It is my poor grandma selling potatoes at the railway station. That is your motherland." I spoke with Ivan Ripiev, a Russian-born theater director, about the frankness of musicians like Shevchuk. "Theater was much more careful than rock music," he told me. "Even if a theater director does not stage anything pro-war, pro-patriotism, and anti-Western, that is already brave." That is a statement people understand. For his part, Ripiev, who now lives in Poland, has criticized the regime and the war in Ukraine. Last year, the government charged him with spreading fake news and sentenced him in absentia to more than 7 years in prison. International stars have contributed, too. In 2022, Grebenshchikov recorded an anti-war song with Stevie Nicks, Dave Stewart of the Eurythmics, and a Ukrainian artist named Serhii Babkin. "The one who is dead in his heart pulled the trigger," Grebenshchikov sings, "and instead of spring, we saw death. The day will come when the war ends and there is light in the sky again. But there, where my house used to be, there is nothing left." "The Russia he once knew is gone," Grebenshchikov told me, "but he's encouraged by the music scene in St. Petersburg, his hometown. New people are coming," he said. "The underground has not died." Next, "Dear James, how do you keep the writerly fire alive?" "Dear James, a few years ago, I started composing odes to my favorite drinks and dishes in Colorado. After more than a dozen years working on another project, in which I wrote long-form navel-gazing essays about being a single father, this seemed like a fun and sustainable way to keep my writing chops in fighting trim while sharing my love for Denver's gems. My goal was to publish one short, impactful, overwrought piece a week. Although I started strong, I eventually dipped to one a month and then to, at this point, only when I think about it. I could blame the vagaries of life in a sense of my columns are getting repetitive. But the truth is, I just don't feel the fire inside like I used to. I was sad when your odes went away, but now I'm wondering if you butted up against something similar. How do we keep rocking rapturous writing when the well starts to run dry?" Dear reader, a very important question. When I was gathering my odes into a book, or rather piling up my effusions into prose and verse and trying to work out which ones were odes and which weren't, my friend Carlo gave me a magical concept. He called it the ode-ness. It's the essential quality, quiddity, floating in the luminous void, uniqueness of whatever you're trying to write about. It's what your ode is attempting to first identify and then celebrate. It's the ode-ness of your ode. And I became quite religious about the ode-ness. I sought it everywhere. What is the ode-ness of a hairdryer, a brake pedal, a ray of winter light, a harsh word in the street? Soon I came to see that odeness is also an inner state of process, a refinement or tuning up of the writer's perceptual equipment, a condition of ode preparedness that seems geared mysteriously toward joy. And then my book came out, and I lost the odeness completely. "You're done being happy?" my publisher's PR chief asked, after I explained to her that I couldn't possibly do another interview about getting under the skin of reality, the unrevealed glories of the everyday, etc., etc. "Yes, indeed, I was done being happy." That was a year ago, and today I'm here to tell you that the odeness, gradually, warily, with altered language, comes back, or one's ability to be in touch with it comes back, which is good news because there's no question that the general imaginative environment has degraded significantly. Physical reality still works in America, as far as I can tell, but mental reality? Holy moly, we're in trouble. I think it's a question of broadening your range. You ran out of juice exalting Denver's drinks and dishes, so maybe go to a little more abstract, odes to moods, sensations, ideas, weirder, less immediately graspable stuff. Take this story, for example, which I've been thinking about lately. It was told to me by my brother. He was at a Red Hot Chili Peppers show in a club in London in the late 80s, and Flea, the Chili Peppers' genius bassist, was mucking about between songs, making his glutinous high-speed punk-funk bass noises, effortlessly doing his runs, pops, twangs, squiggles, doodles. Flea's formula, pluming with pure incidental invention as he paced the stage in his customary state. "Flea," spluttered a man standing behind my brother, a man who was clearly a bass player himself, and who knew now, watching Flea, was caught between revelation and a kind of monstrous affront. "Right, that's it. From now on, 5 hours of practice a day. 5 hours, starting tomorrow." That's the story. That's the experiential nexus. Now there's an ode in there for sure. But what is it? What's the odeness here? Is it an ode to excellence? To artistic transmission? To artistic jealousy? To the bass? To Flea himself? Is it a poem? I don't know. I haven't worked it out yet. But the odeness beckons. Odes don't need to be rapturous. That's the other thing. They don't need to be jolly or even hopeful. They just need to be odes. Slowly improving. James. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.